listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
We welcome you to this session. I don't remember the number. I forgot to look it up. It's the Academic Study of Religion, Prospects and Perils. A reminder of the Sunstone typical starting point. This session is available to those of you who are wearing badges or by ticket, and we appreciate you supporting Sunstone in that way. The genesis of this panel came when I read the endorsement in the Salt Lake Tribune for the program at UBSC that was being proposed, and I did a double take, and I said, what program? And I had to go through the internet and search back a little bit to see the earlier announcements and the articles that generated that. I quickly called Brian Birch and asked him more questions about it, and the idea for this panel began that way. Brian recruited Elaine Engelhart and Jean England to be on that, and we're looking forward to hearing more about the UVSC program that kind of began this whole thing. And then right to Peter Appleby, who unfortunately, as many of you know, passed away. I believe it was in March. He was the second person that we had lined up here. And, you know, if I was more dramatic or if we had a bigger room, we'd leave an empty chair up here on our panel. But Peter is someone who I certainly respected and miss. I wanted to kind of imitate him, so you have to imagine long and lankiness in me, which won't stretch, but his famous move of putting his arms on the podium after hearing from us and saying, "You Mormons are a peculiar people." But with such grace and such open-heartedness, anyway, I know we'll miss him today and for a long, long time. But I am very pleased for the panel that we have assembled here today to talk about this important subject. The UVSC exciting news, as well as just the gains, the losses, the prospects, the perils, the fears, all those things that are associated with whenever you look at your own religion through academic lenses. So we're excited for that. So I want to introduce the panel in the order that they'll go, which is slightly different from what was in your program. Our first panelist will be Elaine Engelhart, who I've gotten to know just through this a little bit. We're excited to have her. She's the Assistant Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of Philosophy at Utah Valley State College. She's taught ethics and philosophy courses there for 23 years. I've seen her on TV. We all have. Teaching some of those courses for EdNet. She teaches the ethics and values courses and the introduction of mass communication courses. She received her PhD in philosophy from the University of Utah, and recently has completed a three-book series with Harcourt Brace entitled Communication Ethics. She's the director of several national grants, or past and present director, through the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities. She currently is directing a grant of $140,000 that's entitled Disseminating Ethics Across the Curriculum. Over 100 faculty and 10,000 students annually participate in ethics programs and courses due to these grants and in many ways, to Dr. Engelhart's activities. She's been recently awarded the Distinguished Service Award by the Utah Academy for Science, Arts, and Letters. She's named Utah Professor of the Year by the Council for the Advancement of Support of Education in Washington, D.C., 1993, directed it until just last year. She also founded the Integrated Studies Programs and directed it for 2 years, from 1997 to 99. She's been the Acting Dean and Associate Dean of the School of Science, Humanities, and Health Sciences at UVSC. She's married to Kirk Engelhart, who's here today. She has two children, Rich and Kelly, who are both in their 20s. Excited to have her, and she'll lead off today. Now, Brian Birch will be our next speaker. Brian's a friend of mine. He's a fellow Claremonter. Several of us here on the panel attended the Claremont Graduate School. Brian is the Associate Director for Religious Studies in the Center for the Study of Ethics, and he's an assistant professor at Utah Valley State College. His bachelor and master's degrees are in philosophy from the University of Utah, and his PhD is in philosophy of religion and theology from the Claremont Graduate School. Brian's main interest, and he is an outstanding facilitator of these questions, I'm always amazed, the philosophical issues in religious diversity, interreligious dialogue, the relationship between philosophy and theology, and the issues of religious freedom. I think you'll really enjoy meeting Brian this way. He's gone sort of the similar direction of Elaine. He's on an executive committee for the State 3Rs Project, which discusses the issues of religion in the public school curriculum. He's the chair of the annual Religion and Humanities Conference at Utah Valley State College, which he began organizing as an adjunct professor, which is, you know, that there's no financial motivation for that. So it's been amazing to watch the energy with which he's been working, from my perspective, a little bit north of him. He's married to Janice Birch. He has a daughter who's 2 years old, Emily, and another one coming, another child coming in October.
Boy.
And a boy coming in October. Good way to go. Eugene England doesn't need much introduction. He wouldn't give me a whole list of things that I could say about him, so I'm going to kind of work in a few here. He's currently writer in residence at Utah Valley State College. He's the director of the Study Abroad program, and he's the program coordinator for the new Mormon Cultural Studies program that's emerging. He's certainly well-known to us all through his books. He's the personal essayist extraordinaire of Mormonism. His latest compilation was Making Peace. Seems like that's several years ago, and you need to get busy. I need another one. He also co-edited with Levina Fielding Anderson, Tending the Garden, which is about literature in the Mormon culture. If there's a Mormon who lives outside his body, somebody whose influence, you know, definitely extends beyond just whatever place he is. I look to Eugene England for that. I know he's got a gravity about him that kind of, wow, here's hanging Gene, you know, and we see his pain sometimes, and he's very open about who he is and how much it's hard to live sometimes, where the things that you do don't seem to always count, you know, and I just love him and appreciate him, and so I wanted to add to those things. He has 6 children, 14 grandchildren now, a brand new granddaughter that he's been talking about over the last few weeks and is excited about it, and he is also on the Board of Trustees of Sunstone. Mary Ellen Robertson is another Claremonter, a great friend. She is born and raised in Los Angeles, attended Ohio State, but her bachelor's degree is from Brigham Young University in Journalism and English. I met her when she came to visit Claremont to, you know, Mormons coming to study women in religion here. And one of the professors that was a major professor knew that I was LDS and asked me to show her around. And it was a wonderful couple hours to get to know her. She's gone like crazy through that program. She now has a master's degree in women's studies and religion from Claremont Graduate School. Her dissertation was on women's spiritual gifts and the relationship to patriarchal priesthood. And I know she's speaking Saturday morning, 8:45, on that. So any of you who would like to know more about what she's been doing, please attend that session. It will be wonderful. I forgot to mention that Jean will also be speaking on a similar subject to our topic today, academic freedom, the values for culture, and his paper will be tomorrow morning at 8:45. Our final panelist, our oddball, looking at him, you might... not grab that. The reason I'm calling an oddball is he doesn't seem to have a UVSC connection. He's not a Claremont connection. And then what I thought was very interesting to think about, he's the only one of us that's outside of academia. He's not working within it now. Scott has a master's in theology or just an MA, or I don't know what they call it. American Historical, but it's a master's degree from Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. I know personally Scott... his essay, At Home at Sea. If anybody hasn't read that, it's in the collection of essays from Signature Books called The Wilderness of Faith. I know I read that about 1990 when I was really feeling not so understood. And to have somebody else who had gone through a theological education and had some of those challenges, Scott's really powerful piece, At Home at Sea, is something I'd recommend to anybody. Again, he is not working outside of academia. I think he's enjoying his life as a bonsai gardener, as an unemployed technical writer. I think he's just done his life right in many ways and is enjoying some freedoms of this. You all probably know of him as one of the founding editors of Sunstone. So I'm not sure that it's in the same shape that it started, but we're all your children, and we're grateful for what you started in those ways. I'll begin turning the time over to Elaine here in just one second. I drive 45 minutes to my work every day, and so I'm addicted to Sunstone tapes. So I'm just going to ask the favor that when the question and answer period, I'm sure we'll have at least 20 to 30 minutes afterwards, if you'd come up and just do it right in the microphone. It's a small enough room, and so I just don't. You know, the translation's never as good as how you've posed the questions yourself, so we'll certainly work that way. So Dr. Engelhardt, Dean Engelhardt, please start.
Thank you very much. I truly appreciate your introductions, and I hope I'm not too repetitive in my comments, because I've been asked to tell you about this institution that will be housing the new Mormon Cultural Studies program. And I must tell you that since the idea came about, it's kind of been a bullet train with Eugene as the conductor and most of us just trying to tag on to one of the cars with our time behind us. So he's really an amazing force at Utah Valley State College, and we're glad to have him there. I started teaching at Utah Valley State College back in 1976, and I started on the old campus that was known as Utah Technical College. We had trade and business programs at the time, and there were a few liberal arts courses that were used to fill out those degrees. But they were Associate of Applied Science degrees, and most people probably felt like those weren't even needed. At the time I started, we had 1,200 students. Well, we've had a few name changes since that time. We've moved from a community college to a comprehensive college. And we've moved from that enrollment of 1,200 students to an increase of 1,800%. We're up to 20,000 students. And I can tell you we have 92% Mormon students, 80% of them are attending Institute, and I truly believe we have the best students from the schools in Utah County at our school. They are incredibly bright students, and I love working with them. One of the amazing aspects of being at Utah Valley State College is that we've had an incredible growth dynamic. And as our dynamic has moved along, we've had to struggle every step of the way. For some reason, the state thought we were the perfect dumping ground for technical education. And it was very, very hard to move away from that into general education courses, into liberal education courses. And I don't think back in when I started 23 years ago that I would have ever suspected that we would have a Mormon Cultural Studies program. I couldn't even imagine what niche it might be in. But I believe that now that we're on that path, that we're on a very rigorous path toward a national program. Humor me for just a moment while I tell you just a little bit about where this fits into the UVSC format. In 1986, after a couple of tries with National Endowment for the Humanities, we talked them into giving us funding to start a core course in ethics and values. They felt like that we made the argument, they agreed with us, that it was very important that our students understand the world around them, that they understood various ways of thinking and looking at aspects of life and diversity. The grant included bringing in scholars of national reputation, summer seminars for faculty, monthly seminars and workshops for students. And it was truly a blessing to have so many well-educated people on our campus working with our faculty and making sure that our courses were taught on a level of national rigor. We were so successful with our grant that we received another 3-year grant from National Endowment for the Humanities, and we added ethics into sciences and history courses at the time. And it was moving very well with many faculty enjoying teaching aspects of ethics in their courses. Then we were ready to move into ethics across the entire curriculum, and at that point, NEH put their foot down and said, we just don't think that doing the technical education is part of the humanities. You find funding elsewhere, and we did. The Department of Education has a wonderful program called FIPSE. They liked it and picked it up, and so we began a 3-year grant where we're teaching and this was back in 1992, Professional and Practical Ethics in All Disciplines on Our Campus. Faculty working with students and area business leaders and other members of organizations on the ethical dilemmas that their students would encounter once they left training at our school. We found it to be an outstanding program, and so did FIPSI. They've really liked it, and we've continued throughout the years since 1986 to bring in scholars of national reputation to sponsor workshops, seminars. We've moved into book groups as well on difficult topics in ethics as well as topics relating to many fields. So, interesting thing is that with our grant, FIPSI liked it so well they said, why don't you disseminate it nationally? And so for the past 2 years, we've been disseminating it to 4 colleges and universities across the country. And from that, we have now formed a National Society for Ethics Across the Curriculum, and we've also formed a national journal entitled Teaching Ethics. Since our first grant in 1986, we have always had a major grant, including one that was K through 12 for teaching ethics in those classrooms. Well, we've come a long way from what I remember as germ-infested carpets on the old UVSC, on the old Utah Technical College campus. And we now have a Center for the Study of Ethics, which was founded in 1992, and it houses all of these programs that I've talked to you about, and they're extensive. In fact, every year, the center sponsors in excess of 100 talks on topics from medicine to law and ethics, air conditioning to geology, from the environment to auto repair. I started as director of the center in 1992. Today, the director is David Keller. He's a native of Utah who received his Ph.D. from the University of Georgia, and his Ph.D. is in philosophy. He's been an outstanding director for the past couple of years. And for 4 years, even though it was adjunct, until last year, we've had the honor of working with Brian Birch in the area of religious diversity. And yearly, Brian has received funding from Utah Humanities Council, as has David for the last 4 years. And Brian's has been to sponsor religious diversity conferences, and they're huge. It is amazing, Ali, that we have so many people who come out and want to hear about the religious diversity conferences. Brian, also a Utah native and was mentioned, received his Ph.D. from Claremont, and he's associate director of the Center for the Study of Ethics over Religious Studies. And now we come to Eugene England, who has been at UVSC for the past 4 years as writer-in-residence. Eugene just received a prestigious grant with National Endowment for the Humanities to fund the Mormon Cultural Studies program at UVSC. So he just heard a couple of days ago, and he can tell you all about that. He really has bragging rights. It's tough, tough competition, and his was said to be by far one of the best grants, so we're really pleased with him. Well, how did all this happen? In addition to being writer-in-residence, Eugene wanted a program in Mormon Studies, and we just kept saying, no, Eugene, we're not going to be having a program in Mormon Studies. We're a state school. We can't do that. And Eugene, no, we really need to do this. It's perfect. Look at our 92% Mormon students. Look at how many are attending Institute. They need to know that they can study the cultural aspects. No, 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 Eugene, you work with Brian, and we'll just do religious diversity and religious studies. Eugene would not give up, for those of you who know this bullet train over here. And so as we talked back to him, we finally started listening. And we said, you know what, we're gonna get in trouble. People are going to think we're either proselytizing or they're going to think we're being critical. And he said, no, 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 it's not going to be adversarial and it's not going to be advocacy. We're going to look at Mormon studies. And I said, really, we won't be critical and we won't be proselytizing. We will be scholarly. I cannot tell you how many people have asked that question since. It must in the hundreds, anyway. And I think that many of the administrators at UVSC have asked all of us, the three of us, that same question probably close to 50 times, anyway. So they're worried about trouble, and they have had calls from the church office building about what we're up to. But we're setting this up just like you'd see a Southwest Studies program, an ethnic studies program. lots of religions have cultural studies programs. And so I told Eugene, I said, you know, I've been really impressed with a Southwest Studies program in New Mexico. Why don't you put in for a grant with NEH? They funded one. Eugene just got that grant, and I think that he will do an exceptional job with this grant, and we will keep asking for funding to develop this. And, you know, the ways we'll study Mormon cultural studies will include workshops, symposium, and great dinners while talking about the best ways of developing and strengthening and sustaining a strong religious scholarship program in religious studies. So what's the program? I'll just tell you briefly a quick program at Utah Valley State College this March. Started out with a great talk from Bert Wilson, 8 a.m., full crowd, and he talked about folklore of Mormon missionaries, and everyone was just captivated by the talk. And I think also comforted that this was the type of project that we were doing. So to wrap up, please participate in this program with you. It is housed in the Utah Valley State College Center for the Study of Ethics. We have a webpage. David Keller is just up a new one as well as the director of the center, and it's just under uvsc.edu/ethics. It's directly associated with the Religious Studies program, and Brian, and he'll give you his phone number, and you can call him at any time or call Eugene. Eugene, of course, is the director of the Mormon Studies program. He's our writer-in-residence. He's over travel abroad as well, now grant director of this new NEH grant in Mormon Cultural Studies program. I think we should find some more for Eugene to do, so call him to get involved. Thank you very much.
I think I'll stand at the podium so you can hear me a little better. A couple of comments before I begin my remarks. Elaine Engelhart has been my mentor at UVSC for the past 5 years, and none of this would be possible without her support and the support of the administration, the school president, Kerry Romsberg, and the academic vice president, Lucille Stoddard. So kudos to Elaine for supporting this, and in many ways the administration at Utah Valley State College is sticking its neck out for us in this respect, and we hope to do them proud and to create a respectable program. Imagine, if you will, that you have been given the task of studying an unfamiliar culture. Where would you start your investigation? Chances are you would start with the aspects of this culture that are most influential in the lives of its inhabitants. These aspects would likely include social hierarchy, economic forces, family structure and gender roles, political organization, and religious belief. But which of these institutions is most fundamental in determining the others? If this culture is anything like others throughout history, the nod would have to go to religion. In many cases, it would be more accurate to say that religion is constitutive of a culture, rather than being one aspect among others. In our tradition, like others, religious beliefs have fundamentally shaped our understanding of ourselves, society, gender, politics, and economics, such that one cannot escape their overwhelming influence upon our culture. Even intellectual reactions against the veracity of religion have presupposed distinctions and derived from the very religion they seek to repudiate. But the question we have to ask ourselves is whether or not this phenomenon is studied to the extent it deserves in higher education. In short, can we truly say that the influence of religion is proportionately reflected in our educational system? I believe the answer to this is a clear no. This phenomenon is especially interesting when one looks at higher education in the state of Utah. It might interest you to know that Utah is only one of a handful of states in the country that does not offer a baccalaureate degree in the study of religion. The last I heard, this number was 5. That's an astounding statistic. This is true despite the fact that Utah is arguably the most religiously influenced state in our union. In our current state system of higher education, a student can receive a baccalaureate degree in other elements that comprise the study of the human condition. These include art, literature, political science, economics, history, ethnic studies. Yet one cannot receive a formal degree in arguably the most influential cultural force in our historical tradition. Why is this so? While much of the answer lies in the larger educational tradition there are important aspects of the local culture that may inform this omission, as well as the non-professional status of the ministry within the LDS Church. The study of religion has traditionally been within the purview of private colleges and universities that have ties to a particular faith. Courses in religion primarily centered around the beliefs of a specific denomination and were largely intended to strengthen the faith of those within this tradition. However, the rise of public education created nothing short of an academic crisis regarding how the study of religion should be approached in a secular institution that cannot endorse a specific theological outlook. In many cases, this resulted in a fragmented study of religion across disciplines, using the methodology specific to that discipline, with little or no connection to its study in other areas of academic inquiry. However, recent educational trends have begun to demonstrate the need for a more unified and focused approach to the study of religion, resulting in the formation of religious studies departments in many colleges and universities across the country. This allows scholars to engage the history, literature, theology, and folklore of religions in the effort to further our understanding of religion as a cultural phenomenon and to deepen our understanding of the variety of religions we encounter within our larger culture. This trend has been felt in our state institutions, and there has been important work done at our colleges and universities. However, I believe that there is much more that can be done in this area of study. It is in this context that we have announced the recent formation of the Religious Studies Program at Utah Valley State College, within which the Mormon Cultural Studies Program will play an important role. This program is currently housed, as Elaine mentioned, in the Center for the Study of Ethics, with Eugene England and myself administering its content. We understand that religion is the most sensitive of subjects, and we're absolutely committed to programming that is engaging and inclusive. And when we mean inclusive both ways. It is important to understand that our aim is neither to endorse nor to criticize religion, but to create a neutral forum wherein issues can be engaged in a spirit of open academic dialogue. All of our events will be free and open to the public in the hope of contributing positively to the community in which we serve. At present, our programming will consist of conferences, symposia, guest lectures, along with cooperative endeavors with related organizations. We believe that this is an excellent beginning. However, the aim of the program is to expand them to include a formal academic program in religious studies and in Mormon cultural studies that is attached to our integrated studies degree. Changes in curriculum move slowly at state institutions, but we are working as fast as bureaucratic constraints will allow. So stay tuned. There is more to come. Thank you.
I also must say a word about Elaine before I start. She may teach ethics, but she does not tell the truth. I think that's maybe an administrator's prerogative. She's now assistant academic vice president at UVS. If it weren't for Lane, I would still be teaching Mormon literature and fly fishing and enjoying it greatly. But as we talked last January about my role as writer in residence, and she began to talk about other things I was interested in and brought up the things that she's done with her grants, she and Brian pushed me into this. And it's really because of her great ability, proven over many years at writing grants and her help with me, that I got that grant. So I appreciate her very much and look forward to working with her and Brian. My heart is very full right now. This symposium represents to me a kind of gathering up together of some of my greatest loves to see how they stand together. My religious heritage, my personal faith, my love of learning, my trust in the powers of the human mind through careful exploration and dialogue with others in an open forum to help humans understand and love each other and improve the quality of their individual lives and their lives together. All these are here in this symposium, open, vulnerable, daring to be for their worth to this community. I believe with all my heart and mind that what we are doing today, the respectful but passionate and personally revealing study of our culture, can make us better as individual people, as a community. is what we did in our first conference on Mormon culture last March that Elaine referred to at UVSC. There, more academically, with a different setting and tone, but still the same kind of thing. And it's the thing we'll now be able, through our grant, to do for a full year, with many speakers, a core group of scholars meeting each month to study specific areas of Mormon culture, and to learn how to do Mormon culture. We're both doing it and learning how to do it at the same time. That's the purpose of this focus grant. At the end of the year, we hope we can demonstrate through a book and a report and an evaluation from the outside that we've learned some things about doing it and get additional funding to continue and expand it. Let me briefly give three reasons I think it's important and valuable to study Mormon culture, particularly as part of Utah higher education. First, in order to combat anti-Mormonism. It may surprise some of you to think that in this nation, which prides itself on religious and ethnic diversity and tolerance, that anti-Mormonism is still a problem. But it is, even here in Utah. Terrell Givens of the University of Richmond a few years ago published a book with Oxford University Press called Viper on the Hearth about 19th century anti-Mormonism. He reminds us there that in no other case in American history has a governor signed an order for the expulsion or extermination of a large part of the state's own citizens, as Governor Boggs of Missouri did in 1838, which led directly to the massacre of 18 Mormons, including children, at Hans Mill by a force of Missouri state militiamen. In no other case have the two top leaders of a large religion been assassinated by part of a state militia, and thousands of those leaders' followers forced to leave, evacuate their homes and temple, and flee into the wilderness. This happened to the Mormons in Illinois in the 1840s. In no other case has the United States sent an occupying army against its own citizens, as President Buchanan did against Utah in 1857, or dissolved a church as a legal corporation and denied the vote to thousands of its members, as the Edmunds Tucker Act did to the LDS Church. Given shows how the American people, while claiming to be the most free and tolerant nation on earth, were able to live with the blatant contradiction of approving these actions against the Mormons by various literary and other strategies by which Mormons were slandered and demonized as ethnically other, not really American, and religiously beyond the pale, heretic, not Christian. In his last chapter, Given shows how some of these strategies persisted in the 20th century and do today, certainly not as violently, but as irrationally, in ways still as inconsistent with the values of tolerance for diversity we claim in America. He cites movies like The Godmakers, which, though pure vicious fiction, using a documentary format that implies it is fact and repeats exactly the strategies used in Nazi films of the 30s to scapegoat and build irrational fear, hatred, and finally violence towards Jews. False implication of secret power that puts Mormons beyond the law, allegation of perverse sexual practices in the temple, and a clear call to extra legal action as the only possible last resource against this irrationally horrifying internal enemy, this viper on the hearth of America. And that film, though produced by a small, extreme group of Mormon haters, continues to be shown and accepted as truth in mainline Christian churches and distributed by respected publishing houses like Augsburg Publishing. The modern version of anti-Mormonism, especially in Utah higher education, reverses the 19th century strategy, but to similar effect. Now, instead of being seen as ethnically other, when ethnic groups are in, and traditional mainstream conservative values are out, Mormonism is refused status as an ethnic people deserving of serious academic study of the kind we are doing today, and it is stereotyped as part of the extreme Christian right wing, with which, in fact, it has very little in common, and by which it is also rejected as being a heretical, non-Christian, even devilish cult. Non-Mormons who care about understanding the people they live among, rather than merely fearfully stereotyping them, need to listen to what we do today and in the coming year in Mormon cultural studies to reduce their fears and help themselves live tolerantly in this culture and to contribute positively and cooperatively to our community together. Second, my second goal in this kind of study, the kind of study of Mormon culture that we plan to do this coming year, in line with the mission statement of UVSC, fulfills a central purpose of any college education for both Mormons and others, which is to move beyond the limited one cultural view we grow up with and become a knowledgeable, respectful, and loving member of a pluralistic democratic society and a multicultural world. The fine Mormon poet Susan Howe recently told a group of students at UVSC that everyone should learn two cultures in order to be educated and part of the human race and overcome our fear of the other. We often emphasize learning about another culture than our own, and many college courses help us do that, whether in language or literature or ethnic studies. But in Utah higher education, we sometimes forget that we must also learn our own culture, if we're going to learn two cultures, self-consciously, with study and understanding. African Americans need to take courses in black history and culture for understanding and self-criticism, as well as pride, as much or more than whites need to study black culture for understanding and tolerance. Similarly, Mormons, as well as the others around them, can benefit from studying Mormon culture. Just growing up in a culture does not reveal to us automatically that it is a culture. One valuable and satisfying way to see the world and to live in it that has certain characteristics, certain strengths, and weaknesses. Albert Peck, in a remarkable session this morning, talked about his ideal of an open forum for Sunstone and the value that he has learned in listening to the other, the genuinely other. He pointed out, I think rightly, that liberals talk about it a lot, but we don't really listen to those who are different from us, read books by conservative politicians and thinkers and culture critics. None of us do that very proactively as we should. The value of an open forum is to provide us an opportunity to do that. I think one of the greatest things Joseph Smith ever wrote, evidence without any other to me that he was a great prophet, is that by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. The central insight that William Blake had, who was also a prophet, I believe, in a different way, that somehow the universe is made in such a way, as Lehi teaches in the Book of Mormon, that opposition and contraries are what give it energy and meaning. And it's working those through in direct confrontation through which truth is best come at. Albert himself is a great example of the value. I was moved to tears as I saw before me a man whose beliefs have changed him, have made him into a genuinely open, loving person, willing to be vulnerable, to take on himself, his own weaknesses and responsibilities. And it's because of his participation in, over 20 years now, and leading and thinking through what it means to have an open forum. That's one of the things we hope to do and to further in Mormon culture studies at UVSC. This brings me to my third reason to study Mormon cultures. Mormons themselves need to study their own culture in order to enjoy and appreciate it better, but also in order to be able to improve it. That is what the Mormon scriptures and Mormon prophets constantly call Mormons to do. Great example in the modern church is Spencer W. Kimball. In his great address, The False Gods We Worship, as Hugh Nibley has pointed out very clearly in his analysis of it, condemned himself and Mormons, as well as all Americans, as being anti-environmentalist, materialist, and militarist, and pointed out how contrary to the scriptures that is and how it makes us into idol worshipers. We put before God things that are less than God, which is exactly what an idol worshiper is. 2 years ago in General Conference, Elder Richard G. Scott reminded his audience that all traditions, all cultures, have elements that are inconsistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. He mentioned some specifically, the caste system in India, machismo attitudes that suppress and denigrate women in Latin American cultures, in some, and ended with a humble recognition that he personally needed to examine his own traditions, which are, of course, American and Utah Mormon culture, to see where it could be improved. We will be doing some of that in our cultural studies. Certainly not Mormon bashing, certainly not criticism of the LDS Church or its leaders or doctrines, but careful analysis and evaluation of elements of our culture that could be improved and thus would improve our local and state communities. Let me give you three examples of a kind of thing that our studies will foster, that I imagine them fostering. One that could be positively critical, one that could be neutral, and one that could be negatively critical. For instance, we've already seen studies, interestingly, mainly by non-Mormons, of what the Mormon culture achieves in the way of physical lifestyle, physical benefits, long life, health, certain values of community and relationship. I think we need studies of what this remarkable phenomenon of the last 20 years of older couples going on mission is doing to them and our culture compared to the rest of the culture, where mainly people retire and vegetate and die. It's a wonderful moving thing to me to see older couples, like the couple last night that we heard from, the Clarks. Sister Clark, Gretchen, bore testimony about how before they went on their mission to Africa, her husband prayed carefully and constantly over a long period of time to have prejudice removed from his heart, the prejudice he had grown up with in Mormon culture, which is racist. Whatever we say about the church, the Mormon culture has been and still is to some degree racist, and we need to face that. He faced it, and as he went on his mission, he prayed that he could remove that from his heart, and his prayer was answered. Now, that's a remarkable thing for a person 70 years old to do, and it's happening to lots of people. Charlotte and I saw the first couple who were missionaries in Africa in 1981 returning to England for a kind of R&R after 6 months there, which they needed badly. And as we met with them and talked with them, we realized that there were two things going on in their lives that seemed contradictory, but they were working through. They were still racially prejudiced, and it came out in various interesting ways. And they, at the same time, deeply loved and were challenged by the otherness of the African people. And those two existed together in them. That's a cultural fact. It's worth studying. And studying people as they go through that process is an important kind of study. What about a neutral study? Rodney Stark has said, scholars of religion are missing one of the greatest opportunities that could be imagined. Most of them would give their right arms to have been present at the formation of Islam. We study the formation of world religions by trying to go back in history and recovering from ancient documents how it happened. He said, right before our eyes, we're having the formation of the first genuine world religion since the formation of Islam, and it's being ignored. That's Mormonism. And right here in Utah, and right especially in Utah County, you have the most intense concentration of that formation of a world religion. We should be studying it neutrally, just to see if we can understand, using the tools of religious study, which Brian knows much better than I do, and will bring to our perspective, how it happens, what happens when that goes on, what makes it possible. Critically, there is much to be done. A person at BYU, not under Mormon cultural studies, but just on his own initiative, because of his own concern, thinking about the home study of Utah County to find out if people in Utah County, mostly Mormons, tended to believe there was a direct connection between righteousness and wealth. What do you think he found? Well, he found there was, but he found lots of interesting things about it. That's Mormon cultural studies. It's not criticism of the church. It's not criticism of the gospel. It's understanding what Mormons believe, trying to think through why they might believe it. He did find there's a high correlation, but he found some interesting things, that the people who believed it less were the very wealthy. His conclusion was that they knew each other too well to believe that their wealth had anything to do with their righteousness. The people that believed it in some ways most damagingly were the poor, whose own sense of value and initiative was hampered by that belief, that the fact that they were poor meant they were unrighteous. But it also affected the middle classes, in the sense that the more they believed it, the less likely they were to help with programs, to vote for programs aimed at doing away with poverty. Well, these are interesting kinds, important kinds of things, positively critical, neutral, negatively critical, that we will be engaged in. It will be scholarly. It will be aimed at cultural study, not at the church or the gospel. And we will be doing it, and we will be learning how to do it at the same time. I hope you will join us. Thanks.
I'll join up. I feel like I've got kind of a hard act to follow here. what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about my background and my experience in studying religion in an academic setting, which is what this program is going to be doing at UVSC, and I'm really excited about it. It sounds like you've got some wonderful things planned. As Dan mentioned, I received a master's degree in women's studies in religion from the Claremont Graduate School last May. And I was fortunate at a time when I was looking for a place to combine my interest in women's studies and my interest in religion. I was fortunate to find a program that combined both of my passions in one place. And while most of my classes were taught at the graduate school, we also took classes through various other campuses in the Claremont College's consortium, and also many of my classes were taught at the Claremont School of Theology. So I rubbed shoulders with a lot of students who were studying to become ministers and pastors, and it was really fascinating to see a different side of this, of ministry preparation, and to see what kinds of issues these students were concerned about as they were preparing to lead and mentor and pastor congregations. My presence there was somewhat perplexing to my colleagues. The fact that I was female was less remarkable, as there were a good deal of women entering ministerial studies. But the fact that I was a Mormon woman taking classes at a theological seminary when I had no earthly hope of being ordained, as many of them were going to be, it made a lot of my colleagues curious about what on earth I was doing there. And so I had to do a lot of explaining about how, even though I couldn't be ordained as a pastoral leader in my church, I nonetheless had a very strong interest in studying religion and finding out what makes religious communities and religious people tick. While I was there, not only did I have to explain what I was doing there, but I also had to disabuse them of some of the strange notions that they had about Mormons. And one of the more interesting assumptions that one of my friends had was that since she always saw Mormon missionaries traveling by bicycle, she assumed that they weren't allowed to get driver's licenses until after they'd been missionaries. So there were a few things like that that I had to iron out for people. I also had to field a lot of queries from well-meaning Mormon folk who I think were somewhat still enmeshed in perhaps the prejudices that Eugene just talked about, that they couldn't really see outside their culture enough to understand why I would want to study that. They were perplexed by my decision to get a graduate degree in religion when I'd gone to seminary, early morning seminary classes, and their concerns tended to be very utility-based, as in, what are you going to do with that? And the follow-up concern was the underlying fact that they thought the more educated I became, the less marriageable I was going to become as well. So the Mormon folk, you know, also had questions about what on earth I was doing in religious studies, and you know, sometimes I would explain if I thought it was worthwhile, and sometimes I would just say, well, I just really like religion. I just didn't want to get into it. Studying religion in an academic setting was very challenging because there was an entire, it was an entire field that I was essentially new to. I considered myself a religious person. I'd gone to church all my life, but I had basically no background in the study of religion as other people study it. I had kind of the basic faith-promoting lifetime spent as a Mormon kind of experience. I'd gone to seminary, gone to Sunday school classes and things like that. But studying religion in an academic setting was very, very new to me. And I felt like I kind of got thrown in and was expected to learn how to swim. And there was a whole new language of religious terminology that I had no concept of. I kept tugging on people's shirt sleeves and saying, what does ontology mean? Ecumenicism? Can you explain some of these things to me? And so, you know, even though I thought that I had a background in this, and I certainly had an interest in it, I really didn't have a lot of the tools that my colleagues did, having studied religion, perhaps in more faith-promoting settings, but definitely more academically oriented than I had. It took me about a semester to acclimate, and I had several colleagues who said, you know, everybody who comes into this program, you know, spends their first semester feeling like an idiot, so you're on course. You're doing just fine. And once I kind of got the hang of it, I really enjoyed the atmosphere there. It was a very intellectually stimulating and charging kind of experience for me to be a part of. And my work in the Women's Studies and Religion program was definitely centered on Mormonism. I took the classes that were required by my program, some of the core classes, and also had electives that I was able to take. And whatever class I was in, the work that I did for the class was definitely geared toward Mormon things. For instance, I took a class on the divine feminine aspects of divinity in world religions, and you know, for my final paper, I wrote on Mother in Heaven in Mormonism. For a seminar on the study of religious communities, I did an ethnographic study of a singles ward I attended in Columbus, Ohio. And for the survey course on major interpreters in the study of religion, the major theorists that, again, a lot of my colleagues had some passing knowledge of before they got to the religious studies program, and I didn't. That was where I was really a fish out of water. But as we're learning about, you know, major figures and major writers in the study of religion from, you know, the 1700s on, I wound up working with Lowell Bunyan's master's thesis on Max Weber's work in sociology of religion and the aspects of those theories that Lowell Bunyan applied to Mormonism, and showed how Mormonism in many ways illustrated the points that Max Weber was making in his work. And as Dan also mentioned, I wrote my thesis on a topic related to Mormonism, the relationship between Mormon women's spiritual gifts and priesthood authority, which was a subject that synthesized my interest in early church history and women's issues at the same time. So I very much enjoyed that process. And although at times I thought my work was perhaps a little too Mormon-centered, I thought, am I spending a lot of time just staring at my navel, you know, introspecting about my own community and not really going beyond that? My colleagues seemed genuinely interested in what I had to contribute to seminar discussions and classes, rap sessions over Mediterranean food, things like that. You know, they always had questions for me about, you know, Mormonism. What do Mormons believe about this? How do you feel about this aspect of the theology? Or they would know some little something and want to know more, you know, kind of the pulled back expanded view of what Mormons believed. And, you know, I was often asked to explain why Mormons were riding bicycles, you know, the phenomenon of church dances. And you know, most often I was asked why I wasn't drinking at school functions when the booze was free. But they had a lot of, you know, fairly valuable questions to ask me. And you know, I felt sometimes inadequate at attempting to explain my own culture and to define elements of it to someone who had no familiarity with it whatsoever. But it was a really invigorating experience for me to be in situations where I needed to do that, that I wasn't necessarily missionizing all my friends, but explaining, you know, in an attempted neutral way what made Mormons tick, what we believed, what we thought. And I had a really good experience taking classes at the School of Theology. I really hadn't experienced really many overt anti-Mormon sentiments while I was taking these classes. Some other LDS students who were in any one of the religion programs at Claremont or at the School of Theology, some of them didn't have quite as positive an experience as I did, but I really sensed that my colleagues, you know, had an interest in what was going on in Mormonism, and they rarely had had close experience with anyone who was Mormon, and so they really hadn't had a chance to ask all the things that they wanted to ask. You know, everything you wanted to know about Mormons but never knew one to ask, you know, kind of thing. So while I sensed that there may, you know, as Eugene talked about, there, you know, anti-Mormon sentiments certainly are not dead, It was really good for me to be in an academic setting where anti-Mormonism wasn't really a part of what was happening. And I realize my experience may have been unique in that way. So the panel, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the prospects and promises, the promise of studying religion in an academic setting, as well as maybe touching on some of the perils. And let me start by telling a story that I think speaks to this. I was at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religions and Society of Biblical Literature a few years ago, and there was a student who was presenting a paper on a Mormon woman. And when we got there and got to his session, he'd actually changed what his paper was about, and what was published in the conference program was not what he actually ended up speaking on. And it was something that was of interest. It was one of the few Mormon-flavored programs, sessions in the program. And Margaret Toscano happened to be attending as well. And so we sat through this paper as this well-meaning, I'm sure, but slightly misinformed divinity student was talking about his work and his impressions that Mormon women in early church history simply passively followed their sons, brothers, husbands, fathers into the LDS church. That it really wasn't any kind of decision they made on their own. And they lagged behind their non-Mormon contemporaries in leaving the farm, leaving an agrarian lifestyle, and becoming more urban and citified, and that they were generally sheep-like, passive, unaccomplished, in their own right type of women. Now, Margaret and I are sitting there getting more and more irritated, more and more agitated at this being passed off as truth. And Margaret was the first on her feet during the question and answer session to disabuse this poor student that, Mormon women were really as he said they were, and had a lot of evidence, from her years in studying Mormon women and Mormon history, that really kind of said, you're a little off base. And I cornered the guy afterwards to talk about what sort of time period he was looking at. And he confessed, I was looking at sort of pre-1830 information. And the church was founded in 1830, so there really wasn't any such thing pre-1830 as Mormon women. So I gave him some pretty good grief on that. Oh, I just kind of fudged on the dates a little bit. Yeah, well, bad scholarship. We're going to get you for that. But the thing that was interesting, it was my first, I think it was my second semester in the religion program. And I was kind of new coming into Mormon studies myself. And so I didn't have a lot of the information that I needed to, stand up and set the record straight. And Margaret did. And what was interesting was afterwards, there had been several other Mormon scholars in the audience during this session at the American Academy of Religions who came up to Margaret afterward and thanked her for being able to set the record straight and defend, the activities of Mormon women. These were very accomplished, definitely non-passive people. And here were these folks from the other university in Utah Valley who knew that something was wrong with what the guy was saying, but didn't have the background in their own religious tradition and their own religious history to defend themselves when there was obviously misinformation being spoken. And so it was kind of an interesting juxtaposition. I think that's one of the key reasons that I saw for the need to study religion, and especially one's own religion in this case. I think that one of the things that studying religion in an academic setting gave me was a context to put Mormonism into, that Mormonism didn't just erupt out of a vacuum, but that there were hundreds of years of religious revivals and itinerant preachers and traveling missionaries and people experiencing spiritual gifts and ecstatic manifestations of religion that predated Mormonism for quite some time. And it's important to have, I think, that background in American religious history to better understand where Mormonism fits into that larger picture. And I think that's kind of where some Mormons have trouble, is it's hard to take a step back and look at the larger picture. Even the notion that Mormons are a peculiar people, referring to oneself as a peculiar people by virtue of one's religion, is not native to Mormonism. That's one of the things that I found out in studying religion, that it was a fairly popular expression to use for religious people in the 1700s in American religious history. So I think it provides kind of a valuable overview of what else was happening in America at the time that Mormonism came to the forefront. And I think that I was really glad to hear a description of more of what the UVSC program is going to be like. And I think that it will be challenging, maybe in some ways, to find the balance between studying Mormonism academically and finding the middle ground between advocacy and adversarialness. Because I think I think that there are two, there's certainly two extremes, but there's a lot of middle ground in between. And I think it will be important to establish the program as being, been said, a neutral forum for academic dialogue and the scholarly examination of a religious culture. I think it will be challenging. It will be well worth the effort. And I just, I just have a few things to say about the perils of studying religion, and I tend to be fairly opinionated about this. I think it's a pernicious notion that the academic study of religion must be undertaken at the expense of faith. I think that is a false notion. I have stronger words written on my paper, but I don't think I'll use them. And frankly, in my own experience, my faith was, and my testimony were in more peril after spending a summer working at the church office buildings than they were by getting a master's degree in the study of religion. So I realize that experience may also be unique, but I think the fact that people sort of perpetuate the notion that it's dangerous to study religion or that it can't be done from a faithful perspective spits in the face of generations of faithful scholars whose life work signifies that faith and scholarship can work hand in hand. And I'm not just talking about Mormon faithful scholars. I'm talking about the entire religious pantheon. That it's challenging. There were moments where it was really uncomfortable to be a Mormon in a, seminary run by the United Methodist Church and explaining and kind of feeling on the hot seat sometimes about my beliefs. But I think at the same time, those who jump into the field of religious studies in the first place are not going to possess such fragile a faith that by studying, it would be destroyed. So I think that the academic study of religion is an amazingly energizing and creative endeavor and completely worthwhile, and I'm really excited to see this program coming into being. And it brings a vitality, really, that nothing else can to a community of faith and a religious culture. So I applaud all of your efforts, and I want to be part of them. Thanks.
You all like to stand for a minute, feel your air, your lungs. In 1978, I made an effort to identify other students that in religious studies programs and in divinity schools who, like myself, were LDS. And I found that in the previous 10 years, that is from 68 to 78, I was able to identify about 36 people. And I haven't kept track of them since then, and I continue to be amazed at how many more LDS people I find who have gone through the process. And I just suggest to Jane or anybody else who's interested, if they want to present a Sunstone paper sometime, is to track down the individuals. I think it would be an interesting cultural study to find out what happens to people when they go through religious studies programs. The crying need in Mormonism is for thoughtful disciples who will not be content with merely repeating some of its truths, but will develop its truths and enlarge it by that development. The prophet planted the germ truths, the watering and the weeding is going on, and God is giving the increase and will give it more abundantly in the future as more intelligent discipleship shall obtain. The disciples of Mormonism, growing discontented with the necessarily primitive methods which have hitherto prevailed in sustaining the doctrine, will yet take profounder and broader views of the great doctrines committed to the Church, and, departing from mere repetition, will cast them in new formulas, cooperating in the works of the Spirit until they help to give to the truths received a more forceful expression and carry it beyond the earlier and cruder stages of its development. B.H. Roberts penned those lines 95 years ago. My grandfather, E.E. Erickson, read them in the Improvement Era. At the time, he was a senior at the Brigham Young College in Logan. He was a son of poor Danish immigrants. And rather than to go on a proselyting mission, he decided to continue his education at the University of Chicago, in part because of Robert's plea for better educated youth. When he bade farewell to his ward in Preston, Idaho, Sister Wilcox warned, "Now, Ephraim, you're going away to Chicago. Be careful and do not change your mind." She was sincere, Grandfather's memoir reads, and had nothing in her soul but a fine hope for and interest in my welfare. But it did cause me to change my mind. It did cause me to reevaluate my heritage. It did give me a larger perspective, but it did not destroy that inspiration which my church gave me. The changes that he speaks about, I think, largely came about through his study of Old Testament higher criticism and ethics in the Old Testament. During his final year at Chicago, his friends and colleagues, Joseph and Henry Peterson and Ralph Chamberlain, were ousted from BYU for teaching evolution. Nevertheless, after completing his PhD coursework in philosophy and economics, he returned to Utah as principal of the church's Murdoch Academy in Beaver. That became his mission. I was so converted to education, he wrote, that when called upon to say a few words at state conferences, I would preach a sermon on the eternal glory of education. I was scolded by the brethren for attempting to make the school more important than the whole church. Elders Heber J. Grant, Joseph W. McMurrin, and James E. Talmadge each reprimanded me on different occasions for the direction my enthusiasm was taking. But he would not be deterred. He jokingly referred to himself as the Apostle of Education. He was hired as the first professor of philosophy at the University of Utah, where in time he became the mentor of Sterling McMurrin, son of Elder Joseph W. McMurrin, just referred to. And eventually, Sterling would be named the first occupant of the E.E. Erickson Distinguished Chair of Philosophy at the U. James E. Talmadge's daughter, Elsie, Talmadge being another person who tried to restrain his enthusiasm for education, his daughter Elsie would co-author senior department manuals for the MIA with Ephraim, manuals that uniquely cast gospel principles in reference to contemporary issues of the time, the Great Depression. Grandfather served 13 missions on the MIA board until locking horns with John A. Widso over whether the organization needed to be, quote, spiritualized. He was released in 1935. In the university ward, he was called to teach the high priest's group until 1940, when he failed to meet the stake presidency's standard of orthodoxy. He was released from his teaching position and was never again called upon to speak or to pray in church. Like my grandfather, I suffered from a passion for Mormonism and the Mormon people. Reed Durham's remarkably forthright classes in higher criticism and church history at the Institute of Religion encouraged me to think there might be a place for me in the system. Wanting a broader background in religion, I went to the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. There, a Mormon missionary gave me a copy of the B.H. Roberts I quoted at the beginning of my remarks. It articulated my feelings so well that I committed it to memory. That's an unusual thing for me to do. The next year, Sunstone Foundation was organized. Some years later, I read my grandfather's memoir and discovered we had both been inspired by the same Roberts article. Like my grandfather, I think my transformation began with higher criticism of the Old Testament and recognizing how Old Testament history, sociology. I read Max Weber, and that gave me great insight into ancient Israel and also how modern Israel history had been proceeding in much the direct, were influenced by the same kinds of issues. Now, some conclusions and connections. First, I would say never to underestimate the power of the pen to influence current and future generations. When I think of what that statement of B.H. Roberts accomplished, it's with his writings, it's been remarkable. Second, education is dangerous, and perhaps I disagree a little bit with the previous speaker. It changes people. Not all in the same way, of course. Some religious studies people have worked themselves out of the church. Others remain faithful and participating members, and some even teach at BYU. Religious and academic institutions rise from different needs and often work at cross purposes. Religion proclaims revealed truths. Academia may question them, challenge them. As William Hofstadter put it, in secular education, truth captured loses its glamour. Truths long known and widely believed have a way of turning false with time. Easy truths are a bore, and too many of them become half-truths. Whatever the intellectual is too certain of, if he is healthily playful, he begins to find unsatisfactory. The meaning of his intellectual life lies not in the possession of truth, but in the quest for new uncertainties. I believe the academic approach to religion can enhance, and religion can enhance one another. And if it is to be achieved in Zion, I believe Eugene England is the one to lead the way. My thanks goes to Gene and to Brian and Elaine for their courage in creating the new Mormon Cultural Studies program. I hope, since I live in Alpine, which is approximately halfway between Salt Lake and UDSC, that you will and make it possible for people who want to come from Salt Lake to UVSC to gather in shuttle buses rather than all adding their pollution as they go through my house to where I live.
We've got that in the grant.
That's good. I appreciate that. I just want to say that B.H. Roberts, wherever you are, the candle still burns. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone. We have about 15 minutes left for questions and comments, and I wanted to draw you into this. If the panel wants to weigh in on a particular issue, I'd like to launch this. I think that might be good if we could share some experiences. So let me phrase the question in the way, and then you need to come up to the microphone to speak. My wife, when I was early in my studies, was working at the church office building. She came across a cartoon that looked at a liberal-looking fellow, and it said his mind was so open, his beliefs fell out, or his testimony fell out. And I thought that was an interesting, you know, she was just trying that one out on me to see if that was what was really happening. So my question would be for anyone to come up or the panel to weigh in on, if you've approached religion from this way, what falls out? But more importantly, with an open mind, what falls or forces its way in? And so if we can kind of lead the, if you have a comment about that, please come up. And then more questions directly about the program, maybe we could save for later. Please, you and then
Dennis. My pants fall down, it's because Gene England has my belt.
Gene England has his belt because Charlotte forgot to remind him to put one on.
a group of us at the University of California at Santa Cruz who've been trying for the past several years to reinstate a religious studies major. A number of years ago, UC Santa Cruz had a very strong religious studies program, and then through a series of retirements and other things, it was phased out so that one of the few people who teaches religious studies at the university is an atheist. It seems to me that there's something rather ironic about a state university which has had a long tradition of religious studies. I worked at UCLA that had a strong religious studies program, and UC Santa Barbara and Berkeley do, and we hope at some point that UC Santa Cruz will have it again. But the resistance against religious studies at the university that I am now teaching at part-time, as I put that against the resistance against religious studies at private institutions within Utah County, it seems to me rather strange that in both instances you have resistance to what is clearly one of the most important areas of study in the world and has been for centuries. And I sensed in the different presentations that were made here today that tension, and I just wondered if members of the panel have addressed that, and I assume this will be part of what you're going to be doing, is looking at both the resistance from the secular world and the resistance from the sacred world, and whether or not you can find a place in here to do what you want to do.
We'll report in a year.
I can mention to you that we truly are looking forward to developing a rigorous curriculum. It will happen slowly, but hopefully you will see some progress in the area. We'd like to move into a minor first and then see if there is interest in a major. But it will be goals of both Brian and Eugene to start developing that curriculum.
We find the same thing down at UVSC. In fact, in the years that I've been teaching the World Religions course down there, there was one section of World Religions taught when I got there, and now there is four. And that is due in part to the growth of the school itself, but it is also due to the fact that the students are interested in religion, and those classes are filling up. And we're turning students away because we don't have enough sections right now. So we find that kind of interest among the students. But we also find hesitation. We realize that we're fighting a battle on two fronts, right? Never start a land war in Asia, right, is the great theme of history, where because you have to start a battle or fight a battle on two fronts. But we believe that it's necessary. We believe that it's long overdue, and Gene's arguments are very elegant in showing why the need is there and the gap that has existed, and we encourage other institutions to do the same, BYU included. I mean, we want to have a healthy relationship with BYU, and want to invite people across the spectrum to come and speak and participate and consult and advise and everything else.
I just point out that this core group of seminars includes people from BYU, UVSC, and the U. Maybe the virus will spread.
Well, let's hope so. My name is John Nicholson. I'm a third-year graduate student in philosophy at Arizona State. In reference to Dan's point of departure for this discussion, I suppose what can happen as a Mormon scholar pursuing especially philosophy religious studies, where you're asking very deep epistemological and metaphysical questions about the nature of your religious experience and the meaning of your community, you can become somewhat insular and, I suppose, somewhat selfish about your own importance in your intellectual quest, which can make you perhaps less than fully serviceable in the community. There was a girl I dated in Arizona State whose father is a believing Mormon, but an apostate. He's an active Unitarian now. He still believes the doctrine of the church, but he felt his understanding of spirituality was not consonant with how his fellow congregants expressed themselves at sacrament meetings. So as a matter of integrity, he felt he needed to lead the community. I see things like this happen a lot. But it doesn't have to be that way. I agree with what Mary Ellen said about faith and scholarship being complementary. As a phenomenologist, my interest in philosophy or phenomenology and analytic philosophy of mind and consciousness, and I'm amazed about how deep I can get into religious experience and the nature of faith as a phenomenon, as something experienced in consciousness with the tools of philosophy. But most of it comes out of traditions such as Catholicism, Judaism, not Mormonism. I'd like to read a Mormon phenomenologist, but they don't exist. There's just nothing to read, and there's so much in Mormon doctrine where there's these big gaps of philosophical silence where you feel like you want to do things, but you're afraid you'll be branded as a heretic or like B. Erickson was, perhaps for some good reasons, but I won't get into that. but it's frustrating. And just closing remark, I have a dialogue I've been engaged with a kind of mentor of mine in CES. I actually thought about getting a job in CES. I think that'll be over with after this week. But I asked him one time, what would it take? What would it take? And this is kind of a reference to Eugene, Albert Peck's remarks this morning. What would it take for you guys to want to come to Sunstone? What would they have to do? You know, just tell me. You know, I'll tell them. I'll be the messenger. And the bottom line was there really was nothing you could do here. As long as there's going to be some negativity by way of an open forum, it's not worth the price, according to people that are the hierarchy in CES or the Brethren in general. I think, and I've shown various people in CES the programs, and they go through it. Go to this one. This is interesting. Tell me what it's like. Avoid this one. This could be negative. Whatever. It's really kind of funny, but they won't go. And the ones that do go won't participate except as audience, because I guess the premium is on developing character in a certain way, a certain type of personality, the Mormon personality. Culturally, perhaps you can tell me why you think that is. But since that's what the premium is placed on, the scholarly neutral study is almost subversive by its very nature because it's not advocacy, and it's not going to be championed. I think it'll be allowed. I'm glad. I guess it's being allowed now. You got this grant. You got this program going. See how long it lasts. But I don't see a lot of hope. I mean, maybe in 100 years. I was talking with Dean Faulkner at BYU about what he sees in CES in the next 50 years, and whether we can get more scholarly emphasis and less pastoral. And he said, and he was pretty, he had the same attitude I did. He said, well, maybe we should take a reverse psychology with the Brethren and say we need just pastoral emphasis in church education, and maybe the Brethren will just react to the scholars and do the opposite. that's what he said. I paraphrase, but that was his offhand remark. So I guess this is a real circumventory discussion, but I hope there's more hope, but I think it'll be big 50, 100 years before Mormons will be informed and comfortable enough with their faith to ask hard questions about their culture and community and prepare themselves to dialogue more effectively in interfaith discussion. My thesis chair is an ordained rabbi in Judaism, and I've learned so much from him about my own faith. It's been such an invigorating experience, and yet I'm constantly having to defend BYU. He actually supervised Steve Epperson's dissertation. And I had a long discussion with Dean Faulkner trying to get the facts so I can defend BYU if I should. But that's all I have to say, right?
Let me introduce the person who's coming up. Dennis Potter is our newest faculty member in the Humanities and Philosophy Department at Utah Valley State College. And we are very excited to have him here, and we're trying to lure him in to helping us with the religious studies program. So we'll see. Yeah.
You don't have to do very much luring, I don't think. my question actually is it's mostly for Gene. He talked about a sort of positive criticism of Mormon culture, and he used as the example studying our culture and realizing that it's racist. And this is clearly something that we would all, in fact, most mainstream Mormons would agree that something we should eliminate about our culture. Even the ones who are racist would agree that we should eliminate this because it's the politically correct thing to say. But at the same time, I wonder I'm afraid that this idea of positive criticism of the culture might sort of slide into also criticism of the religion or criticism of the theology, and here's my concern is I don't know that there is a very good distinct or a strong line between culture and religion, your religious culture and your actual religious beliefs or your theology. And a lot of people, some minorities in the church, or in the church back in the 70s, would have said that the racist beliefs that they have was central to a religious belief. And so that would actually be a criticism of the theology. It would be a criticism of the religion and not just of the culture. How are we going to get around that the problem of there not being a clear distinction between the culture and the theology?
2 minutes.
I think that you're absolutely right, but I will deny it if you tell anybody. We are going to pretend that there's a difference and that you can keep them separate and act as if you can, because to a large degree you can. But of course, you cannot finally separate Mormon culture from Mormon theology and the church. But our job is not to point that out. Our job is to help us, because we've failed so long to see that there are differences, that we have a culture in addition to the church, that we're going to focus on that. That's what the academic study is engaged in. And of course, when we need to, we'll have to recognize, well, theology for a certain time certainly subsidized racism. That's now changed. You can point that out. Does present theology subsidize certain things? We're not going to point that out. And it will take 100 years, and you will be right. But I believe with all my heart that you're wrong. I think we can do it.
No more time. We appreciate all your participation. Hope you'll come up and chat with everybody here again and support the program every way we can.